Okay, so this is gonna be a bit more astrophysical than plasma physics. So I hope that's okay. but I think there's a growing interest in sort of the galaxy formation community in cosmic rays and what they can do in galaxy formation. And I think it would be good to make contact between our community and your community, because I think, yeah, I mean, we're improving models, but there's still a lot of the details of the microphysics that we can and should try to get better. But I'll just highlight some of the work that I've been doing, collaborating with Christoph and with Rüdiger Packmoor, Volker Sprengel, and the Arepo group. So I'm just gonna give, usually when I talk to give this talk, I'm talking to people who know very little about cosmic rays. So I'm instead gonna talk a bit more about galaxies and why, what are the outstanding problems and why are cosmic rays interesting in galaxy formation. So probably I'll do less of number two, but then three, I'll talk about some of the simulations I've been doing of cosmic rays in the interstellar medium and in galaxies, and show you some results, some published, some preliminary unpublished. So if you have any thoughts, please let me know, and then just some ideas for future directions. So I'm just going to begin with sort of the cosmological issue, one of the main cosmological issues we have in galaxy formation, and that's just understanding the stellar mass, the luminosity of galaxies that we observe. So if you run, you know, Lambda CDM predicts sort of a density of dark matter, of baryons, of dark energy, and from the cosmic microwave background, and we can predict from that model what the overall fraction of mass is in baryons. And that's something like 0.17, 0.19. It depends what your fit is for the cosmological parameters. If you then try and say, okay, well, I have my galaxy survey, it's volume limited, I can sort of say what is the distribution of galaxy luminosities, and then I look in my cosmological simulation where I simulate the formation of dark matter halos and I get a distribution of halo masses and I try and match them up. What does that exercise predict for the halo occupation occupation of galaxies? So this is like stellar mass to halo mass versus halo mass. And you can see basically at all scales, we are well below the cosmic predicted from the CMB predicted baryon fraction in terms of stellar mass for galaxies and dark matter halos. So we need to explain this. and it's also not constant. Like it peaks at L star, it drops off at the low and the high mass. And sorry, please stop me. Is this too simple? Is this too simple?
No,
okay.
I'm not
oh, okay. all right, let's be kind to each other. So sort of the picture that we've been developing over the past, you know, 10, 15 years is at the low mass, there needs to be some kind of feedback process that, you know, galaxy formation feedbacks on itself, it makes it inefficient, and most of the baryons do not end up in stars that power the luminosity of galaxies, the optical luminosity of galaxies. So sort of at the low mass end, we sort of hypothesize it's some aspect of stellar feedback. What that is, we'll talk about. And then at the high mass end, maybe it's something like AGN feedback. You need a more powerful engine, you have a deeper potential well, you need more energy to create that suppression. So I won't be talking about that at all, and there are many people in this audience who are quite expert on the high mass end here anyway, more than me.
What are the acronyms, AMCC mean? By the old curves.
Oh, abundance matching?
You have those curves in there, references. It's a different technique, I guess.
Yeah, I assume so. This is just a collection of different.
AM is probably abundance matching. Perhaps they see something else.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, Yeah, sorry, I don't know off the top of my head. But
I think it
yeah,
might be cluster luminosity.
cluster luminosity.
HODs, it's halo occupation distribution.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think like there's a variety of ways you can try and do this exercise. You can change things by a little, you can't change things by enough. Stellar feedback. So one aspect that we have clear evidence for stellar feedback is galactic outflows. Like we observe this. So this is M82, which is shown in every talk about galactic outflows. It's one of the best examples in the local universe. And a few things to point out, like this is a composite image. I believe the blue is X-rays. The red is cold gas, molecular gas, I believe. And so you can see like, and then the green is optical. So this is the starlight of the galaxy. And then you can see it's launching these biconical outflows that are multi-phase. So you have both like, million degree gas and, very cold gas as well, in the same outflow. So outflows, at least some of the ones we see in the local universe, are multi-phase. This one seems to be indeed associated with star formation in this galaxy. Of course, like I said, I'm not going to talk at all about other kinds of outflows like AGN jets, et cetera. But we see this happening in the local universe. And of course, like, you'll just say, well, M82 is a special galaxy, and it is indeed special. But I mean, we have evidence in a variety of observations for outflows. So, this is again looking at local universe galaxies. But if you look at this is using modeling of UV lines that probe sort of warm gas, so like 10 to the 4 Kelvin gas or so. You can model the dynamics of gas that's being traced by these lines, and we see quite fast outflows, hundreds to thousands of kilometers per second, and these speeds seem to correlate with the star formation rate. So this is sort of evidence for outflowing gas associated with star formation. And then just, we've sort of alluded to it a few times in earlier in the conference, but just like where you find metals in the universe tells you about how gas is getting out of galaxies, right? So if you just look at quasar sight lines and look, this is versus redshift. So this is looking at absorption from different, this is a particular species of carbon, looking at absorption from these metals. These quasar sight lines are passing through the IGM, so regions where you're not necessarily hitting galaxies, but you're hitting gas in the intergalactic medium. And we see pretty rapidly the IGM enriches. Like we see metals in the IGM, and that enrichment continues up to present day. I mean, maybe it's leveled off here, but we see metals aren't just being made in the IGM, they're coming from the galaxy, so they have to get deposited there somehow. So winds are an obvious candidate.
That plot there is the, so that's velocity, but what about momentum,
Oh, yeah, I guess, yes, I pulled this. I believe this paper does have some data on some plots on momentum as well. And I think they try and, I think the color coding here, they're trying to discriminate winds of different momenta, if I recall. But yeah, I refer you to their, Heckman and collaborators, they've been doing a lot of really interesting work on modeling emission lines and local galaxies tracing.
Some colors like green and blue. I can't read from here, Lago.
So it's some kind of momentum relative to some kind of critical momentum they talk about in their paper. I don't recall the details, to be honest. And also, like, I'm not an observer, so I'm not probably the person to ask for all the details.
What's in the cubicle you just came from, obviously?
I mean, from the Milky Way, it should be 500 or so kilometers per second from the solar circle. These are not the Milky Way, so these galaxies are going to be a variety of masses, and so you would have to model for each galaxy what the escape would be. That would depend on the potential of that system. So yeah, but I mean, it's going to be in hundreds range for an L star galaxy. Yeah, so some of these are sort of, you know, star bursting systems and might be in larger potentials. So it could be, so what that 1,000 means could be different in those systems. So you would have to go on a system by system basis. Yeah. Okay, so you know, we have evidence for outflowing gas that can be fast, although, you know, it depends on, you know, what the potential is, whether that's an escape velocity. We see that it sort of correlates with star formation rate. You know, we see that there's metal pollution in a variety of contexts in the universe, indicating that this is, you know, gas, you know, gas being enriched by star formation is being injected from galaxies. So how do you go from star formation to, you know, galactic scale winds or, you know, metal pollution of the IGM? Well, it's a multi-scale problem. We've talked a lot about multi-scale problems here. This is maybe a different set of scales than you're used to thinking of, but, you know, you have stars, supernova regions, H2 regions. These are, you know, tens to hundreds of parsecs, you know, for supernova remnants and H2 regions. You know, galactic scale winds that I was showing you in M82, that's, you know, tens of parsecs, maybe 100 parsecs if you're looking at something, you know, quite large. And then, you know, if you're considering, you know, metal pollution of the IGM, you know, or metal pollution of galaxy clusters that was mentioned earlier in the conference, you know, that's going to be many megaparsecs, you know, away from systems. So you need a way of coupling, you know, these scales to these scales. And so what are the relevant physics? And this is in part what simulators have been trying to understand in galaxy formation in the past, you know, 10-15 years. And there's been a lot of ideas that we've tried, and they're varying claims, and I won't get into all of them, but, you know, you have, you know, just supernova explosions. They can heat gas, they impart momentum, especially if you have supernovae that are clustered. You know, they can deposit more momentum than individual ones. You can have radiation from young stars that can ionize and then heat. The radiation can also exert a pressure. And then, of course, now we've become more interested in cosmic rays. And I think, like, this sort of first, I mean, caught my attention and caught many people's attention in the field with this work by Salem and Brian. This was sort of the first work using sort of a more modern galaxy simulation code that is well suited to do cosmology problems. For example, this was done with ENSO, where they model a cosmic ray fluid. So they just model, they don't model the energy distribution of cosmic rays. They just model it as a second fluid that has an energy density. And they just have, the cosmic rays can advect, and then they can diffuse isotropically also relative to the thermal gas set by a diffusion parameter kappa. And, you know, they did both tests of isolated disk galaxies, but also ones, cosmological models as well. And they found, that, yeah, indeed, like, if you inject cosmic rays and you don't allow diffusion, what happens is you puff up your disk, so the pressure of the cosmic rays changes the structure relative to just having no cosmic rays. That's this model here. But then if you start to allow them to diffuse, and they test a few diffusion coefficients, this kappa, you start to make these very nice disks, which is sort of an outstanding problem in galaxy formation. We also not just want to get the baryon content correct, but we also want to get the structures of galaxies correct. And so this was a very interesting work, and there's now a number of groups working on sort of similar models where you model the cosmic rays as sort of a second fluid that, you know, advects and then has some other additional transport terms, most commonly diffusion, but now people are also working on streaming models, et cetera. And so this is like a very active area.
Why, without cosmic rays, they didn't get disks? I mean, it seems like disks were, people were getting insinuation.
Yeah, so I mean, this, it depends on the model. Yeah, so in this particular model, they did not. So there are other kinds
some
of...
galaxy?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just the particular feedback model, non-cosmic ray feedback model they were using was just not very efficient in halting overcooling, essentially. So
there should be still conservation of angular momentum.
Right. But if you're dissipating energy too fast, if you're just cooling very rapidly, you know, you're not, you're going to just clump all in the center. Did you want
to
say
something? Well, you still have to have conservation. Something has to break.
Yeah, right.
I don't agree that if we just have dissipation, we need to get rid of angular momentum. And angular momentum, we need either magnetic field or some friction.
It's actually the opposite problem. You actually have to throw the low angular momentum material out of the galaxy to maintain a large disk. And that's what, why actually the successful models of galaxy formation now have actually started to do this with recipes, driving sort of the winds out by hand. And that is sort of what started in 2016 with the first models that successfully got then the disk galaxies. And that model sort of did not want to sort of go this route. So they wanted to have a physical cause of these winds, and that's why there are no cosmic ray models are clumps. So this is actually too much low angular momentum material sitting in the center, that's why you get a clump. And if these cosmic rays remove this central low angular material, then you maintain sort of a nice disk. That's
yeah.
why the model is successful.
And it, I mean, and I, to be fair, there are also models that don't do winds by hand that are also successful in making disks, but they have, because you can have clumps that will, through dynamical friction, you know, in a disk, they will come to the center. So the idea is you have to disrupt them before that happens. And so, you know, there are a number of groups that also have models like that, like gasoline and fire, et cetera. So there's sort of two ways of doing it.
I always thought of cosmic rays as it's a nice addition, which helps
yeah.
in some cases.
Yes.
So are you saying it's like the best thing ever?
No. I mean, I'm just presenting what they were finding in this paper. They're using a rather, I must say, sort of old-fashioned feedback model that had known problems and just sort of saying, okay, like if we add cosmic rays, you know, but I mean, I think no one thinks that this particular model is doing the correct thing anyway. So I guess I'm just sort of showing you sort of a worst case scenario, and you know, it can help.
Mateusz? Yeah, so I'm actually coming back to Christoph's. I'm just not sure if I understand the argument. So if on the right hand side you have no cosmic rays, so you're not removing the low angular momentum gas, so you see the gas in the middle, that's
yes.
the gas that has low angular momentum.
Yes.
What happened to the gas that had high angular momentum? Why is it no disk in addition to that clump in the middle?
Well, I mean, that particular gas dissipated too much basically through cooling, and then it ended up in the center, so we had this overcooling catastrophe. I mean, starting in 98, Matthias Steinmetz sort of had the first models of galaxy formation. They all were these dense, cold, clumpy nuggets that did not look like galaxies. And for 20 years, people struggled how to make right galaxies, and then they realized, oh man, we have actually too much low angular momentum material in the center. So let's throw it out, and then people started to sort of expand.
And to be fair, for a long time, people thought it was just a resolution issue, purely. And I think we've come to realize it's not just a resolution issue. So, like, you know, you have a resolution element that is large. It contains, you know, maybe 10 to the 4 solar masses worth of gas. If you put in, you know, the appropriate amount of supernova energy for its star formation rate, it will immediately cool. It's like it does nothing, essentially. And so people thought, well, if you just increase the resolution, you know, you will eventually fix this. Like, it's just a matter of, and people have then were able to do quite high resolution simulations, and it still didn't fix it. So we're, you know, that was, yeah.
What dictates the initial distribution of that?
I mean, it depends on the simulation setup. So I think this particular paper was taken from their isolated disk simulation. So I think they set that up by hand in this case. They also have models where they run a cosmological model.
This is from the cosmological
model. Is it from the, okay, I'm sorry.
They're right next to each other.
They're right, okay, yeah, okay, so sorry. They did both, but I think they were seeing the same thing in both, but roughly. But essentially, they've done models where they set it up by hand, and the cosmological, you know, models, it's to do with, you know, cosmological accretion. That's not something that they control.
Are you saying that in this no cosmic ray, my model is just that because there is too much of low angular momentum gas, we do not see high angular momentum gas? This is the issue of contrast for...
Yeah, either the high angular momentum gas loses its angular momentum through some process, or it just does not form in the first place, and I don't know. I didn't run the simulation, so I can't tell you the details.
You're sort of asking, is it just to unveil the low angular momentum and the high angular momentum stuff is just there?
Oh.
Or is it a...
No, I think the high angular momentum stuff is not there.
It's just not there.
Yeah, that's right.
But the Lustres and the Lustres TNGA don't have cosmic rays, but the galaxies there look pretty good.
Because
they put in the winds by hand to do this by hand.
So the winds are tuned to throw out the way.
Yeah, in Illustrious, et cetera, yes. There are other models so this model does not attempt to do that. They do not try to put in anything by hand.
Supposedly, like fire, they don't do that, right? So how do they? Okay, maybe we should have done
that. Okay, I mean, we can have a discussion like this, but maybe that would be good for another time.
Okay.
But yeah, there are models that try and launch winds self-consistently. And the way they get rid of low angular momentum gas is a different approach. Whether it's the correct approach is, you know, something we can discuss.
Well, the clusters can drive winds as well, so it's...
Well, yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, but the question is, are you actually modeling them? Like, you know, some of these... You know, fire simulations, I would argue, are not, like, they do not have the resolution they claim they have. Anyway, we can.
Chris, just speak.
Just speak.
Oh,
just talk. No one is raising their hand and waiting, so just talk.
So, sorry, really basic question. So, how do we constrain the energy density of cosmic rays? Like, how do we pick what PCR should be in, like, a simulation?
So, I mean, we have, so in this model, sorry, maybe I wasn't clear, they are injecting cosmic rays as part of their feedback model. So when they have a star particle, and every time step, it will deposit some amount of thermal energy and cosmic ray energy into the mesh. So this is a mesh code. So, when you deposit the cosmic rays on the mesh, then you're putting that in effect into the second fluid. And so the density of the cosmic ray, the pressure is just the cosmic ray energy density, essentially, right? So then it's just the amount of energy you've accumulated in that cell, you know, divided by the cell volume, right?
And do they leave that as a knob that they can tune how much cosmic ray energy?
Yeah, I think they do some tests where they maybe play with that efficiency a bit. I think, you know, there are sort of that parameter is something that, well, we take from, you know, work from this community, essentially, like in a supernova remnant, how much of the energy gets converted to cosmic rays. And so people, 10% is a typical number people use. I think they used in their fiducial model here, 10%, I'm going to use 10%, but, you know, there's work suggesting that maybe it could be 5%, maybe it could be 20%, you know, it is a number you could play with. I don't know, I mean, I think, though, you're depositing, that's like just your source term, but then also how it diffuses in this kappa term is also important in terms of how much cosmic rays you have then collecting in the ISM. So what they're varying here is kappa.
Is there primary observations from the galaxies like this?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about some of my own simulation work, and we've done some work, and Christoph's, and we've done, so maybe I'll go to my own simulations, and because I'm trying to describe a paper that of simulations I did not run, so just to motivate where this field is going, coming from and going to. So we have a model in this code Arepo, which is also a mesh code, where, again, cosmic rays are modeled as a second fluid. They impact, you know, the dynamics of the thermal gas through their pressure. And I guess I should also say, like, cosmic rays follow a different equation of state. Rather than a gamma of 5/3, it's a gamma of 4/3. So that also can potentially be important in their energy density. We assume that the cosmic rays are sort of imperfectly coupled to the thermal gas. So we get an advection term and then a diffusion term. I'm going to just talk about our anisotropic diffusion model. So we only diffuse along, so this is just a unit vector in the direction of the local B fields, this little B here. And so, of course, this may not be the right equation to solve, you know, I don't know. There are other people working in Arepo on alternate, you know, equations, transport equations. Maybe streaming is important. So Timon, maybe at some point, will talk about his work in this line. But we're just going to talk about the diffusion picture because that's what we've done simulations with so far. And we also include some cosmic ray cooling, Coulomb and hadronic losses. So then some fraction of cosmic ray energy thermalizes in dense gas.
What's the difference between V and VST?
Oh, yeah. So this is sort of a general equation where if you were to allow a streaming velocity, in the models I'm going to talk about, VST is zero. Mm-hmm. So just ignore that. Sorry, I should have taken that out.
So V is the velocity of the gas.
The thermal gas. That's right. So you might have some additional streaming of streaming velocity as well, but we're not treating that.
Lambda is cooling and gamma is source.
Yeah. That's right. Yes. So we have source terms, which are going to be our supernova explosions, and then we have sink terms, which then will actually, the energy's not completely lost. It then goes into, it's then a source term to, there's another equation for the energy of the thermal gas, so, right? The thermal energy, right? So there's, you know, there's three more equations and then an MHD equation. I'm just showing you the cosmic ray equation here. Yeah, exactly. So it's No. So we just pick a constant kappa, and we do not model. We model the energy density, ECR of the cosmic rays. We just assume that they, you know, we don't know anything about their energy distribution. There's a single, yeah. So just think it's just the GeV protons. That's all we're doing, right?
Only we're integrating all the distribution function, and Philip has now added a module to actually follow the individual spectrum bins. He will be coming later in the program.
Yeah, so Philip Garahidis is working on improving this in the code.
But technically, on each spatial cell, can you characterize local turbulence level based on your hydro?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, yes.
Which would affect that kappa?
Yes, no. Well.
So I think the pressure-carrying GV cosmic rays are not confined by external turbulence, but rather by self-excited turbulence, the self-confinement picture.
But if they were self-confined, you should have streaming.
Correct.
Yes.
As I said, this may not be the correct equation for what we're assuming.
So
but this is what we're doing, so we're going to go with it.
It actually is extrinsic to this, because, I mean, in fact, if you set the streaming velocity equal to zero, I think it's indistinguishable from confinement and extrinsic to this.
You could argue that it's an effective diffusion coefficient that is the streaming velocity times the cosmic gradient length. But I agree. I mean, this is sort of in the extrinsic confinement picture, yes.
The only thing with determinants is you wouldn't necessarily have the anisotropy in the same way.
Maybe, yeah.
But it's something in between, like, cosmic and
well, no, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, for example, if you were scattered by, you know, if it were Jarry resonant scattering, it would still be predominantly.
But non-resonant. We have larger macroscopic.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's some kind of eddy diffusion,
But for transalphanic turbulence, then there's no difference between the parallel diffusion and the perpendicular diffusion.
With respect to the mean magnetic field.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we only see the mean magnetic field.
I mean, the injection scale of turbulence. Oh, yeah, I mean, mean field, yeah.
So you're doing MHD cosmology.
Yes. Well, I'm going to talk about some ISM simulations, but yeah, we've applied this to, well, we now have some cosmological simulations, but we've also done isolated disks that are, you know, cosmologically motivated, et cetera.
Can you describe those features?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So these are just from some of our publications. So, you know, Christoph has a paper just describing the general model, and, you know, he does some simple tests of, you know, supernova remnants and looking at some isolated disks, et cetera. And then Rüdiger Packmore is the person who wrote the diffusion solver. So then he has a paper, on the solver methods and also on simulating isolated disks with the diffusion solver, and unlike the previous work of Salem and Brian, you know, we do have MHD. It's not just hydro. So then, you know, he found some interesting differences in the magnetic field behavior based on, you know, the presence or not of cosmic rays. And then we have some work by Svenja Jakob, who then sort of took these isolated disk models of Packmore and applied it to, because he was just looking at Milky Way type galaxies, and so then she did a variety of halo masses from sort of 10 to the 13 down to 10 to the 10, I think, and looked at sort of the efficiency of the cosmic rays in driving outflows, and so here I think she's just showing the gas velocity, so, you know, upwards versus downwards is red and blue. And sort of halos of different masses. And so, you know, she did find, like, as you go up in halo mass, it becomes, well, the potential is deeper, it becomes harder to drive outflows, and you don't really above a certain halo mass. And then as you go down, it becomes easier. And the sort of mass loading of the winds or the outflows driven by the cosmic rays.
The same color scheme between the middle and the.
It's the same color bar.
So it means the gas is now falling in rather than going out.
Yes. Yes.
So, mm-hmm. Our future versions of the slide should put in another gradient for the diffusion term.
Yes.
Okay.
No, I mean, it's a Tibian.
Okay.
Del square.
Okay.
It is out there.
Yes, sorry.
Correct.
I think this is correct.
Okay. Yes, it is. I didn't see the brackets.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
So still our ones at the bottom, right?
Wait.
They look like a jet, so I'm just, you know.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Like, it was, so, yeah, the outflows, so it was like as you went down in halo mass, from the very low mass galaxies, it was more distributed, like outflowing gas, whereas sort of in the, so this is Milky Way mass, and this is like 10 to the 11.5. There it was very concentrated in the central region. It was sort of, yeah, this.
My understanding is that this is a global simulation. You don't really have the resolution to resolve the inertial range of.
We're still in the intro here, so I don't know how far I'm going to get. So in these models, we are not simulating the full phase structure of the ISM. We impose an equation of state for the ISM. We just assume that our hydrocell contains, you know, below the resolution scale of the cell, a hot phase and a cold phase in a pressure equilibrium.
So in this case, your B field is not really local field.
Well, it's local to the scales we resolve.
Yes. What scale?
I mean, these are three different papers, so I don't remember.
I think typically, in the central part, we actually get down to a resolution of tens of parsecs in the central part. So that means we have the field structure on 10 parsecs. Now, of course, this quickly degrades if you go off into the halo or out in the outer galaxy.
Yes.
Because that's a moving mesh code.
So, I'll just briefly mention, so this is a mesh code. We are discretizing volume, but our discretization scheme follows the flow of the gas such that it minimizes, so this is just a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability simulation showing you the mesh structure. And so essentially, like, we improve Galilean invariance with this kind of mesh discretization scheme. And so even though we are discretizing volume, we are sort of Lagrangian in the sense that we have sort of constant mass, we have constant mass in our resolution elements, that makes sense.
But you change their shapes, right?
So we change the shapes, and there is a mesh regularization scheme. You don't want them to get too weird, the code doesn't like that. But essentially, yeah, so you have some irregular shapes. So then you, to solve like the Riemann problem, you have to put yourself in the frame of cell faces, right? And then you can solve for the left and the right state, essentially. So my actual work. I'm glad we've gotten here. So I'll just try and be brief. So these are the galaxy simulations I was showing you before, run with our repo Coster Gray diffusion solver. We're assuming a stiffer equation of state in the ISM, assuming this pressure equilibrium between a hot and a cold phase. You know, this is sort of, you know, back to like McKee and Ostreicher, this sort of picture of the ISM. But here, we've sort of thrown that out. And what we're trying to do is actually self-consistently model the development of molecular gas, its associated cooling, cell shielding using a sort of sophisticated Heelpix algorithm. So in each cell, we sort of compute columns, you know, around the cell to compute the cell shielding of the molecular and the atomic gas. We include MHD, of course, self-gravity, a uniform interstellar radiation field. So we don't have a varying radiation field, which you might expect.
For the self-shielding, you're doing RT on the fly, or?
No, we're not doing RT at all. So we just have a uniform ionization field. So there's some ionization field that gets fed into the rate equations. But for each cell, we discretize the volume, you know, in steradians around each cell center, and compute the column density in a three-dimensional way to estimate the amount of shielding on the cell. So we would like to move in the future to a full RT prescription, and we actually have a paper by Raul Kanin, who's applied an RT method in Arepo using exactly the same simulation setup. And so we want to, the next step is to marry the two, and then we'll have RT plus cosmic rays.
What is this self-shielding?
So you know, you have this interstellar radiation field. We're not actually modeling the transport of radiation, but we do know that there should be, if we were to do so, some, you know, the field will, like, it will not penetrate into dense regions. So you need to estimate how much shielding you have in certain directions, or, you know, how shielded is a cell based on its location in the cells around it. So you have to compute columns, column densities in a three-dimensional way around it. So we sort of chop up the volume around each cell, we compute a column, and then we, rather than solving full radiation hydrodynamics, which is also a complicated problem, but we do want to move to that. So
forming stars?
What's that?
Are you forming stars
here? No. So what we're doing, so maybe here, because I have equations here. So what we do is, in each cell, we compute a probability for supernova explosion based on a local star formation rate. So that's based on the cell mass and the free fall time and efficiency, which we just take to be 1%. So then we then just inject supernovae by hand. And it is the case that, and I'll show some models later, where if you have radiative cooling and if you're not coupling the supernova energy to dense gas, like, you can get sort of a runaway cooling in local cells. So then you do have to impose a pressure floor, which I was not going to go into the details of. I don't know if it's of interest to this group, but it is a problem. So so anyway, this is just showing you some behavior of this model. So here we just put in thermal supernova explosions in based on this probabilistic model. So the energy couples to dense gas, and this is well known, this will not really do much in terms of driving outflows because the dense gas cools most of the energy. If you then put 10% of your supernova energy into cosmic rays and you only allow advection, so you do not include the diffusion term, you will just puff up the disk, but you do not sort of drive large-scale flows. If you then allow diffusion, you can then allow the cosmic rays to diffuse ahead of the thermal gas, right? So you now have a way of transporting the cosmic rays independent of the bulk motions of the thermal gas.
Scale height distribution of the disk?
So we just assume thermal pressure equilibrium. So we just assume an isothermal, yeah, so 10 to the 4 Kelvin, that will...
It's pretty thin.
And is the surface gravity characteristic of the Milky Way?
Yes, no? Yes, sorry, I missed that, but yeah. Yeah, so I guess I don't say here, but it's sort of tuned to the Milky Way at the solar circle, so sort of 10-ish solar masses per square parsec.
In gas. But the gravity also comes from.
Yeah, so you assume you that that is yes, and then we assume a gas fraction, right? Relative to the stars, and we assume most of the mass is just in the stars and in the gas.
So what is the probability in inversely proportional to the mass of the cell? I can understand that the star formation is proportional to mass, that's fine. And then if you substitute that in, you'll have that the probability of the supernova is independent of the mass. So there must be some reason why it's 1/m.
Oh, okay. Because I think, okay, I don't remember the details. I'd have to look up in the code, but yeah, that's a good question. So I don't know. Okay, we have some choices here. So I've got 15 minutes. I can talk about, choose your own adventure, guys. So we can talk about the effect of altering the diffusivity, the effect of altering the placement of supernova explosions. We can talk about observables like gamma ray flux or and magnetic field orientation.
First one.
First and third.
Yeah, first and third.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll just keep going, and we'll see how far we get. Okay. So, okay, first thing is I have this constant kappa, and of course there are reasons to think that it should depend on turbulence, on energy, on all these things. We're not modeling the energy structure of the cosmic rays yet, but what we can do is we can just vary this constant kappa. So we've done this. So this is looking at sort of the velocity of gas above, sort of above the midplane, so not the central turbulent motions, but the gas motions in the wind, and so we see kappa scales. I mean, this velocity of the wind does scale with kappa, as you would sort of predict based on just like the mechanism. I don't think I said this, essentially. What is happening is the cosmic rays are able to diffuse. They set up a large scale pressure gradient in the box, and that is sort of the escalator that moves material out. So you then see that the sort of slope of this velocity difference does scale with, you know, the pressure gradient, as you would expect.
Can you read then, the y-axis for velocity?
Sure, velocity in kilometers per second. And so
it's 10 to the 2, 10 to the 0. 10 to the 2.
Yeah, so this is sort of one of these linear log scales. So it's linear between -10 and 10, and then it's log from 10, from 1 to minus 1, and then from 1 to 1,000, it's log. So this is 1. 10, 100, 1,000.
Is it clear what we're going for in terms of a number here? Because let's, like, if we're trying to match.
Well, so mass loading is often what people are trying to get out about the wind. So how much material are you.
Or I guess my question is also, like, these are local simulations. Mm-hmm. So there's also could be an effect of, in a global 3D sense. If we ignored cosmic rays, we would get different.
Yes, because the wind. Yeah, so this is a known. Do we
have a sense of, like, in a local simulation, then what kind of velocity do we want from this, such that in a global simulation it matches the.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, so it is the case that, yeah, in a global simulation you would allow the wind to sort of expand laterally, and in this case we have periodic boundaries in the lateral direction, so an expanding wind would run into itself and stall potentially. And so you're sort of going to be sort of underestimating perhaps the wind velocity.
Here, if you launch too strong a wind in the local box,
yeah,
you might worry if you want to put it in a global thing, it might actually.
Right, it might be too fast. Yeah, no, it is a good point, and we do want to run global DIS models to test exactly that.
What's the mass of this galaxy?
Well, this is sort of based on a local surface density. So it's not. It is selected to be like the Milky Way at the solar circle. Of course, you could imagine being in the more central regions of a lower mass galaxy. Although then the gas fraction would change because we're also assuming a gas fraction. So it's the two. Selection, the two setup parameters are the surface density and the gas fraction. Okay.
What's the emission profile of the gamma ray?
Okay, we can get there.
Okay.
Okay. I guess maybe this is of less interest maybe to this crowd, but one thing, you know, we're very interested in galaxy formation is sort of what is the mass loading of the wind. So how much of the star formation energy how much of the star formation is driving the outflow, right? So you can look at this as an energy loading or as a mass loading. So here I've sort of computed a mass loading, so the mass loss from the box divided by the star formation rate. So per unit of stars formed, how much mass do you lose from the box, right? So actually, we kind of find that in these models, and of course they have known problems, we might not be estimating this correctly due to geometric effects, but at least in this case, we find that with kappa, it's sort of, there's this broad range of kappa where it's sort of constant, it's sort of about one. And then, of course, if you start dialing down kappa too low, then it starts falling off. We've not yet run simulations at the higher end. It might also, I would sort of predict it will fall off again because you'll just diffuse stuff out very quickly and it won't impact the gas. Let me just skip this. Well, someone asked about gamma rays, so maybe I'll just skip to that. So we do now have from Fermi estimates of, we have measurements of the gamma ray flux from a number of galaxies. So the black points are detections. The red points are sort of upper limits and systems with AGN, so you're not quite sure what is doing the emission that you're seeing. But for these systems, we're sort of sure. So here's the Milky Way at lower, and this is versus far IR emission, which you can convert to a star formation rate. So this is sort of showing you that the gamma ray emission correlates with the star formation rate of galaxies. So this is the Small Magellanic Cloud, the Large Magellanic Cloud, Milky Way, M82, which was I showed in the beginning of the talk. And then you start going up to very high starbursting galaxies. This is ARP-220. So there is this observed relation. In sort of our global disk models with this simplified ISM picture, Christoff had a paper using a model assuming just a power law for the momentum distribution of cosmic rays in each cell. So the slope of that doesn't change between cells. You just change the normalization. And based on that, estimating a flux from pion decay, and then he has a way of estimating emission from secondary electrons through inverse Compton scattering, although this is the emission that dominates. So you basically can ignore this for now. But so one question we had, and this is sort of preliminary and sort of what I've been working on last week, was how do our boxes compare to this? And so this orange line is just a fit to the black points. So I've just extended this down. So this is 10 to the 37. This is 10 to the 37. That's roughly where the SMC is at. So if you just sum up the star formation rate in our boxes and you estimate, here I'm just doing the pion decay part. I mean, the inverse Compton scattering might be a 10% effect. Sort of our fiducial model with sort of peak driving, that's the cyan square. We also have some models where we adjust the placement of the supernovae. And depending on that model, you can have more or less dense gas. So some of these models start to fall off the relation. And I think what's happening is we have a model for cosmic ray cooling through Coulomb and hadronic losses. And so essentially, we're sort of losing energy through that channel, and they're falling off the relation. So that's an issue with the structure of the ISM or with our cooling model, to be determined. We also have these circles, our models that are just like the peak driving with the cyan square, where we change the kappa. If you make kappa too low or low, which are these circles, you start going above the relation. I think essentially because you drop the star formation rate because you puff up the disk, but you still have enough dense gas and you've trapped all your cosmic rays in the midplane essentially, and that sort of gives you too high of a flux for your star formation rate. So you've moved both to the left and maybe up as well. And then if you make it faster, you will start to drop below it, I think, for sort of similar reasons. So,
so for the circles, do you also have hadronic coupling losses?
Yes, yeah.
So they don't lose energy?
Well, you're coupling energy into the dense gas, so you just don't have as much dense gas that does this, although we do have models now with, I don't have a slide on it, but one of the things I've been doing this week is getting together the models that have the different injection models and the different diffusivities. So that's, you know, there's many parameters and we have to sort of put them all together.
Is your thought, or if you wanted to explain this relationship,
yeah,
is it because there are more supernovae or there is more dense gas, or it's both?
I think the more dense gas is maybe important, is perhaps, at least in like my models, that is what's the biggest lever. But of course, like ARP220 is like way outside of the regime of what we're simulating here. So I mean,
more target.
Yeah.
Is the supernova rate proportional to the mass?
Well, I mean, I think in roughly yes. I mean, you have like the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, although starbursts are sort of a special situation.
You're putting stuff into the simulation.
Yes.
You're just putting supernova rates proportional.
Yes, to first order. Yes. Yeah. So we sort of, yes, to some degree, we're getting out what we put in. That's
so
true.
The kappa you get, if you compare that to the cosmic ray, glide cosmic ray transport kappa, are they?
I mean, I think sort of the average sort of Milky Way value, it's a few times 10 to the 28 is sort of what I'm told by people. So like we've been using 10 to the 28 as sort of a fiducial value. Maybe we should be using something a slightly higher.
Was it isotropic?
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing. But then I think we discussed this. Okay.
So when you make the density high enough, it becomes insensitive to kappa or to wind or anything
yes.
like that, because the loss times are just so short. So my former student Toga and Yost Hall did these models. I mean, the lifetime of a cosmic ray proton in an environment like ARP220 is between 100 and 1,000 years. Mm. Okay, so there's
yeah.
no dynamical or diffusive process which competes with that. And the result, so this is kind of an empirical result, not what you're showing here,
right.
is that in those situations, cosmic rays and magnetic fields are not in energy equipartition, because even if you mm. have a strong source of cosmic rays, their lifetime is just so short that you can't build up an appreciable energy density.
Right.
So above a certain star formation rate, it's just hopeless to drive a wind.
Well, there could be other mechanisms.
Wait, I would be careful. This is taking a galaxy as a single zone, but if you have a structured multi-phase ISM, it could well be that they live in the warm phase and cold phase. They are deplenished. I mean, so
well, this is the central molecular zone of ARP220. But yes, it is a one zone.
But I mean,
well,
I think also in starbursts, the radiation feedback might actually be
yes,
quite important, and we are missing. I mean, well, we've not addressed that in this talk. Yeah, exactly.
Ratio of loss time to diffusion time in your run?
I don't have that number.
How far did the cosmic rays get before they lost their energy?
I don't really have that number off the top of my head, but I think it's also like we're modeling the cosmic rays as a fluid. It's not like we have tagged cosmic rays. But
you're coming
at
that now.
Yeah, that's right.
Then the escape time must be like
yeah.
10 million years or 20 million or something
yeah.
to, you know, go back to the parsec. And
you
know, we know
walk?
Just wait, I'm not done. And we know that, we also know that the galaxy, our Milky Way is about a, you know, 10-20% calorimeter
yeah.
of protons.
Right.
So if you make the interstellar medium 10 times denser,
yeah.
then collisional losses will compete.
Yeah, because we also have some boxes that we've changed the, like, we can't do ARP220 conditions in this kind of setup, but we can do factors of like 2.5, you know, and so we'd like to build up some intuition looking maybe at, yeah, things like that.
How big a range of kappa are you varying?
So we varied it by several orders of magnitude, by four orders of magnitude. So 10 to the 28 is sort of what we've been using as our fiducial value. We've done the lowest kappa we've done is 10 to the 26, which I think it's sort of like an advection plus model. Like the cosmic rays really don't leave the midplane. And then we do runs up to 10 to the 29, and there the diffusion is quite fast. And you can see here, like I've plotted, these are slices of different kappa models. This is just the cosmic ray energy density. You might want instead to look at the cosmic ray pressure to thermal pressure. So you can see here, and you can see like in our highest kappa run, like in the wind, you get quite like the energy is really dominated by the cosmic rays. They are just you pump them in the midplane and they leave immediately, and then they eventually leave the box. And then you do have faster or larger momentum.
The issue here is that your kappa is uniform.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is like this. Yes, I 100% agree. That's the main issue. But we've got to start somewhere. So right.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Here your coupling of cosmic rays, which is essentially happening because of the streaming, will depend on the level of turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
And this why rough estimates show that in the disk, we will have little coupling. And because level of turbulence, at least in Milky Way, is large enough to suppress streaming instability. But as soon as we get to the halo, where the alpha Mach number is smaller, in this case we will have this coupling. And this, in fact, can make it more efficient in driving fast
speeds.
But I think last week we have seen a talk by Giovanni and Elena, and actually sort of showing us quite nicely that it's breaking the cosmic ray spectra, and that the sort of Born-Lukaven ratio indicates that in fact this is a propagation effect, and very suggestively implying that you actually self-confine below 200 GeV, a GeV.
They're self-confined, they did not specify where. And I claim that it will be self-confinement already in the lower density gas where you have less intensive turbulence.
That is like a problem, sort of problem. Yeah. So it includes the entire halo.
Yeah, so this is one sample.
I guess one last point, one last point I'd like to make, maybe this, because this is something else I've been working on while I've been here, is looking at the structure of the magnetic field. So of course, like we don't have shearing motions in the disk, so we're somewhat limited on what we can say. But there are some interesting things we found, and so just looking at the fraction of magnetic energy and sort of the z direction, so the vertical direction, and then the two horizontal directions. That's what these lines are, and the midplane is at 5,000. And so in the midplane, you know, we initially start with a magnetic field that is oriented horizontally, just in a uniform direction, and we find that, you know, after, 100 megayears, that field is all jumbled. You have sort of equal energies in the x, y, and z components. This is a line of one-third, so they all meet. Then as you start moving up, you know, above and below the plane, in this particular model at least, we see that, yeah, you start to have, because we do have this outflowing gas, we start to get more ordering of the magnetic field in a vertical direction. So this is, the blue is the Z component, And so we sort of find that it sort of, at most, at least in this model, it sort of saturates out to like 2/3 of the energy in the magnetic energy is in vertically oriented, and then the remaining energy is split equally between the two horizontal components at 1/6. This is a line of 2/3, 1/3, and 1/6. So I mean, this is like very preliminary.
What special
is that being stretched out?
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, in the galaxy, you would expect it to be horizontal.
Yeah, because you have shearing motions.
Am I confused where you are?
Oh, so this is mid-plane. Sorry. So this is the mid-plane.
Oh, okay.
So, sorry, the box, yeah, I should have set this to zero. Sorry, this is fresh off the presses here. But
All right.
So this is the mid-plane. And then, yeah, it's interesting, around 500 parsecs above and below, you reach this state.
So you're up to, I mean, it's probably carrying out.
Yeah, that's right.
That makes more sense.
Sorry. So, and so this is like still sort of work in progress. And in part, it does seem to vary depending on our placement model. So, I didn't really talk much about this. This might be of more interest to sort of an ISM community, but, you know, I've been showing you mostly models and this regime where we're sort of efficient. We have this probability tied to the local freefall time for the injection of supernovae. We know that supernovae don't happen in dense gas mostly. Like, we have supernovae happening in clustered ways. We have them happening in H2 regions. We have them type 1As that are just sort of completely decoupled from their birth clouds. They have no, and you have like runaway massive stars even. You know, most massive stars are born in binaries, and you can have ejection processes. So, and indeed, when you do a coupling to the dense gas, you find that the phase of gas that is volume filling is sort of warm, which is not what the real ISM is like. So you need to have some fraction of supernovae coupling to low dense gas, and you know, just adding in cosmic rays does not, you know, fix that volume filling fraction problem. So we do find like you do need to change the placement of supernovae. So what I did is I sort of hacked up this sort of hybrid model of where you can smoothly adjust the fraction of supernovae happening in dense regions versus randomly in the midplane, while preserving the average Kennicott-Schmidt star formation rate for the box, if that makes sense. And so here in the top panels, I'm just showing you progression from like completely peak driving all the supernovae happening in dense gas to completely random. And you know, as you change this, you start to see you fragment the ISM more and more. And if it's completely random, you have the hot phase volume filling, which is, and you have most of your mass in dense molecular clouds. If you add in the cosmic rays, it changes the energy balance, right? Because you suddenly have this additional pressure. And so as you put in supernovae explosions, that pressure acts as sort of a stabilizing force. And so you need to put this transition from like warm volume filling to hot volume filling happens. You need to have more supernova energy coupling to low density gas in order to get the structure of the ISM sort of right. And the transition sort of ish, it happens more rapidly as a function of random fraction as well. And a number of other properties change. So I guess like one thing I've become more interested in from doing this experiment is, you know, we initially started working on this problem to understand galactic outflows, but just in sort of our basic understanding of the structure of the ISM, including cosmic ray pressure, might be important. Maybe not a radical change, but it is something to consider. Thanks. Ryan? Yeah.
So I was just wondering, and this might be more of a question for the general audience, but do we expect cosmic rays to be injected with the same fraction from type 1A compared to type 2?
I mean, it's the shock where they get injected. So if the shocks are the same.
But I don't know about the injection are more or less 20% type 1A and 80% type 2 supernovae. But just because they are more numerous, the Korkalov supernovae are more numerous than the type 1A.
But so they have the same sort of shocks.
They have more or less the same fraction, yeah, because they release both 10 to 51 air in total. So 10 to 50 air in total.
But the type 1As have a greater scale height, don't they? Their galactic distribution is a little different.
I mean, the medium they're expanding into might be different. Does that change the shock and maybe change how things are accelerating?
Yeah, but it does not change because usually efficiency is not strong functional.
But maybe the magnetic could, if the magnetic field were different at a higher scale height in the galaxy.
Yeah, because you're interested in more in 1 GeV, 10 GeV.
Yeah.
Right there. Mm-hmm. This change maximum energy that we want to reach.
All right.
But for 1, 10 GeV,
it will not matter.
Okay.
Great. I guess I sort of made all the points I wanted to make. Roughly. Yeah, sure. So thank you all. Yeah.